Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is a novelist, essayist, and poet. His work in the San Francisco literary scene in the late 80s and early 90s helped put gay writing on the map long before it was a niche marketing category. His book, Through It Came Bright Colors, won the Farrell Gromlio Fiction Award and Bookspan's Violet Quill Award, along with being named one of the top 10 novels of 2003 by Gay Today. Well, he has two new novels out right now, Fawn and A Horse Named Sorrow. Trevor Healy, welcome again to Out in the Bay.
Thank you, Marilyn.
It's really good to see you again.
It's
think so much of your
too.
Work.
We had a great time last show.
Why not? Well, you write vividly in A Horse Named Sorrow of San Francisco during the AIDS crisis. It's touching, it's moving, the ACT-UP days. It was quite a different place then, San Francisco, wasn't it, in the early 90s?
Yeah, it was very different. It was a sort of interesting kind of golden age. There was all these amazing creative things going on. Everybody was very animated and alive, but it was also very difficult. I mean, it was sort of like the really intense dark stuff, which brought out a lot of the really good light stuff. They went back and forth, and it was hard, but there was something, you felt alive in every single way, and it was exciting in that way.
People were dying around you. The diagnosis of AIDS, not HIV. We didn't call it HIV, we called it AIDS.
Life was intense. Everything was intense, and you were finding out about a new person who was ill every day, and it was just this, just everything was alive. You know, there was no kind of sleepiness, which I think now it's very easy to sort of get into a sleepy mode.
Because we're not in crisis.
Right.
So we can afford to relax, perhaps.
Right.
But it wasn't a relaxing time. It was an animated. I like the way you use the word animated. And the gay men, you know, gay men were dying, and some gay men were not dying.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about this in A Horse Named Sorrow, a man who falls in love with this young, beautiful man who ends up dying.
Right. One of them is sick, and one of them is not, and they go through that as very young men. And I wanted to write about that specifically because I was in my 20s at that time, and it felt closer because I was shocked when, oh my God, that guy's 23 like me. It could happen to me. Because I think it was easy to be complacent when you knew about safe sex and you were young. You felt, as long as I'm safe, I can be helpful and be involved in all these different things to fight the epidemic, but it's not going to come knocking at my door type thing. And when you'd start to meet people your own age who were ill, then it started to become more real for you. And I wanted to write about the people who had that experience as very young people because they really, you know, they were just, some people would come out and they'd get sick and die. I mean, it was so shocking and sad because it was like this person didn't have an adult life at all. No one even got to know them, really, you know. And I wanted to sort of do this for kind of those people in a way. You know?
And a lot of people came here spurned by their families, rejected, maybe still in the closet, and came here to die.
Yeah.
In some ways, Jimmy, your lead character that he falls in love with, well, the lead character is Seamus.
Yeah.
He falls in love with Jimmy. And doesn't Jimmy come here from Buffalo to die?
Jimmy actually came here to die because another thing that was amazing about San Francisco was there was this incredible community that had been built up to support people who were ill and dying. And people would come here because it was a better place. It was a better place than Buffalo to die, to go through this experience. It was the support. And a lot of that comes up in that movie that's out recently. Is it the We Were Here, I think it was called?
We
and that really brought a lot of this back for me, too, and was interesting that it came out at the same time.
Yeah, you had food, you had health care, you had a community that embraced and supported you, unlike where you were coming from, where you had nothing, people hated you or feared you, especially fearing you if you had AIDS in those days. How do you see San Francisco today compared to the time you write about in A Horse Named Sorrow?
You know, I've been living in Los Angeles and in Buenos Aires recently, so I can't say that I'm living in San Francisco day-to-day to judge it exactly. But,
no,
I mean, I come back here a lot. My family lives here. I have lots of friends here. I come back. I love San Francisco. It's home. So, you know, but it is, you know, the whole tech boom and the dot-com thing, all that has happened since I left in 97. And so it's very different. I mean, it doesn't have that urban grittiness. It's gone through that Manhattan experience of, you know, no, Manhattan's really, like, clean and glittery, and it's not that sort of down and dirty, cool, scary, you know, exciting, anything could happen for better or worse feeling that it was, you know, in the 80s. And San Francisco has lost some of that, too. Although, you know, you have to look harder for it.
I think we have the homeless to, you know.
Yeah, in some ways, the city's the same with just a slightly different makeup on it. But in other ways, you know, I'm older. That's weird, too, because when you go through your own life process, you know, this city can't be the same thing it was when I was 23 and wide-eyed.
No.
So it's hard to compare anything, really, the place has certainly changed ways I've changed.
Well, you write so much about the Castro District, and I want you to read that piece from your book in a few seconds, but you write so much about the Castro District, and you think about it now, and if you've been there lately, it's a very, very different environment.
Right.
There are still a few gay male bars.
Yeah.
With a few old drunks hanging out.
Yeah, I remember I used to love the used bookstore, Books, etc. I'd go there and hang out all the time. And then there was the donut shop. And kind of a lot of weird people hung out in the bookstore and the donut shop. And I remember when the donut shop closed. Do you remember the donut shop on the corner of 18th and Castro? And I felt when that was gone, something was really lost in the neighborhood. It was no longer a real place. Because that was a place people would go in there at 3
gluten
in the
free,
morning. Yeah, there's no donuts anymore.
Yeah, we don't want gluten anymore, apparently. We ate so many donuts, we now can't have any gluten ever again. Yeah, it's a very different time and very different energy now, and it's much less. The Castro back in those days was always just only gay men.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of time there, beginning with Harvey Milk, into the 80s, all through the 80s, and then all through AIDS, and then it shifted and changed because so many people died, I suppose.
Yeah, and then it did feel like a political center, too. You would go down there to find out what's going on,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, it was a buzzing neighborhood. There was a lot, you'd go to find out what was going on in all different kinds mm-hmm. of aspects of your life, and now I feel like it's a little more, I don't know. It's just a neighborhood, right, where you go to be gay, I guess, and to eat and hang out. And
to be hip. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't go there as much anymore,
right.
You know, but
my guest here is Trevor Healy here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. He's the author of Fawn and A Horse Named Sorrow and a dozen other books and lots of poems, and he's been writing for many years. I wanted you to read a little bit from A Horse Named Sorrow.
Okay, yeah, I'll read a little bit.
It kind of paints a picture of San Francisco back then.
They go to an ACT UP meeting at one point. ACT UP gave me a sort of team feeling, a kind of power I'd never been familiar with, loner that I was. Although it often felt hopeless, too, reminding me of what a veil of tears life was. Of course, it helped that ACT UP was loaded with cute guys, and angry cute guys at that, which gave them sex appeal and made me feel guilty. Mostly I took pictures, so I made it art and history, too, which was something. I needed something, because Jimmy was going to die and then I'd have nothing. So in the end, as always, the guys and girls that ACT UP, like the kids at the Y, gave me more than I ever gave them. I showed up, did my little part, and I appreciated that they never asked for any more from anyone than what they wanted to give. They were mostly young guys in their 20s, many of whom, like Jimmy, had it, disabusing me once and for all that it was a 70s guy's disease. There were young, punky guys in leather jackets and mohawks, baby dykes with nails through their noses, radicalized middle-aged men who'd lost their safe place in the gay bourgeoisie.
You described the gay male sex scene in San Francisco at that time as, the pinball machine that was San Francisco. Why that image? How does that come to your head?
Well, that's what it felt like to me. My life was like that. It was, you know, guy to guy. You were bouncing all. You didn't know who you might meet in the next 10 minutes, and then you'd meet someone else, and it was sometimes insane, and you didn't know where you were, and you're just flying all over the place. And, you know, part of that is being in your early 20s as well.
At your sexual peak.
Yeah, you know.
At your most sexual.
Or your most sexual hyper, or whatever you want to call it, yeah.
Do you miss that time? Is there anything about that you miss?
Yeah, I mean, it was an exciting time. I miss the excitement, but I think there's also memory involved in this. And again, it's like, you know, I remember it as exciting and all that. I think it was also really like a roller coaster. I was really miserable and freaked out. And everything was too intense, actually. So in a lot of ways, I don't think, if I'm really honest, I really miss it, because I think memory usually, you know, we remember the better things than the worst things. So I think it was a hard time emotionally. I remember I was all over the place.
Now, this book took you, A Horse Named Sorrow is what we're talking about here with Trevor Healy on Out in the Bay. This book took you 15 years to write. I mean, talk about that process of trying to, I mean, because it's incredibly personal, this story. And it's a very intimate book, and it's very lyrically written, and it's got some magical feelings in it. It's just dreamy and lyrical, and it's really arty, this book. And yet it's very concrete and very, here's a story and here's dialogue and here's what happened to these people. It kind of combines both those things in the way that you write. And I'm just wondering, what was it that was so difficult about writing it? Because it was so true?
You know, I wanted to write this sort of poetic prose, which is really hard to do and to do it right. And I felt like this was a really important story to me, for me as a writer. And sometimes I just felt stuck with it. I couldn't get it right. So I'd go and write something else and publish another book and then come back to it or try to. And I gave up on it many times. But I felt like there was something about it that was saying, you have to get this just right or you can't do this. You can't publish this or anything. And so it took a long time. I kept coming back. I kept giving up on it. I just felt like I can't do this until it's ready. And I, you know, it's strange because you get to know these characters. They're like friends. I've known them for 15 years. I mean, you know, I've been living with them. So it was a very intense book to finish.
And you did that by leaving this country.
Yeah, I finished it in Argentina. I was stuck in a lot of ways. Yeah. I went down there just to do something completely different with my life.
And you were stuck?
I was stuck, and I wasn't writing, and I thought, what the hell am I doing? And I was 48, I guess, when I first went there, and I thought, I need to do something. I'm bored. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I mean, I can just keep writing these books, but what about these books I can't finish, and I'm not really feeling like writing, and so I'm going to go study Spanish, which is what gave me something to do so that I wasn't just floating around. And I got down there, and the people are incredible, and I just loved it. And I don't know why I went there. People say, why'd you pick that? And I said, I don't know. I just always had this feeling. So I just went with the gut of, like, I'm going to Argentina. I wanted to go there when I was five, whatever. Here I go. And something in being in this completely different environment, which always helps me, is the creativity came back. You know, somehow it's like I scraped away whatever rock had formed over it. And it all came back out. And this book just came through. And it was weird because sometimes I was traveling and I'd be like, you know, staying at some hostel with my little laptop thing. And I'd like try to find some cafe that had Wi-Fi or that had a plug so I could work. And so I was this kind of weird traveler. I wasn't really seeing anything. I was finding a place to type, you know. And it was exciting, though, to be in all these different places writing away. I mean, it was really kind of that wonderful fantasy writer experience. And
because it was pouring out of you.
Yeah, just pouring out of me. And then it was really interesting to be living in a place where you're speaking Spanish and you're using Spanish to live, and the only time you use English is for the novel you're working on, which intensified the process of writing for me, and I think that helped.
Well, you know, Gertrude Stein, who emigrated to Paris, basically, she never came back here hardly except for some book tours, but she loved living in France, and one of the things she said is, because here I have English all to myself.
Yes, yes.
Which I always thought was so great.
Yeah. And there was that feeling. It became sort of precious because most of the people I was hanging around with didn't speak English. So right. English became this precious thing that I was using for my creative life. And then I also think being an expat, you're free of all the primaries were going on this last time I was there. But, you know, to be free of all that kind of stuff, like all that nonsense that, mm-hmm. that clouds your mind. And when you're in another country, you don't pick up as much of their nonsense yet. It's kind of you haven't gotten it yet. So you're kind of very like a child. It's like, oh, you know, there's food and people smiling at me, and I don't know all the nasty
other things
that are behind all that, and I won't find them out for a while, hopefully, although you want to find out as well. But I think there is a liberation. It makes space in your head.
And then you moved to Chile.
Yeah, well, I was studying Spanish in both places, so I sort of started in Argentina. I went to Chile, lived there for a while, and then I came back. I really prefer Argentina, so I ended up back in Argentina.
And you wrote Fawn, the novel that you also released around this time recently. You wrote Fawn also in these other countries.
This, you know, both of these were like a book of sorts, and I had to fix them and finish them. So I focused on Horse. I finished that, and as soon as I was done, all right, now let's go back to Fawn, and I was able to get back into Fawn and finish that. So it was just this great kind of period of I can do anything right now, so just keep going, you know?
Wonderful. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is novelist Trevor Healy, the author of many books, including Fawn and A Horse Named Sorrow. You can find him at Trevor, that's T-R-E-B, B as in boy, Trevor, Trevor Healy, H-E-A-L-E-Y, TrevorHealy.com. Let's talk a little bit about Fawn. It's about a kid who becomes a fawn.
Exactly.
Tell us about that.
So this is like my first L.A. book, you know. I moved to L.A. and I've been living there off and on. And this is about a kid growing up in East L.A. who begins to morph into a fawn. He starts noticing he's got these little nubs on his head and his legs are getting very hirsute.
You're going to read that piece.
I'll read a little bit for
That'll
you.
Be fun.
And his mother's very religious, and so she's starting to worry about maybe her son's turning into Satan or something. It's a little more of a humorous, kind of madcap, crazy adventure story. I'll read a little bit. Of course, it was not only Senora Rubio who was disturbed by the changes that came over Gilberto that year, but the boy himself. The hair that sprouted on his face, the overnight increase in the size of his chocolate-brown nipples, and the hair that grew now like sparse grass atop his sternum, the way it flowered in his armpits and spilled like bougainvillea over his genitals. The sudden length and girth of his manhood astounded him. It looked like something that belonged in a butcher shop. And his balls were now the size of plums, when a month before they'd been like little kumquats. He'd been 13 one day, and then the next it was as if he'd turned 22. So he has to deal with this, and he doesn't do it too gracefully.
But it creates a scandal. I mean, he gets into...
He's a force of sexual nature. Basically, he's like Pan, and so everybody around him is suddenly horny. He doesn't know why. The whole high school, they're about to shut it down. You know, I mean, people are getting pregnant.
The girls become pregnant,
right.
People
are amorous. Everyone on the street, when he walks down the street, flowers are blooming. The dogs go at it. So he's completely freaked out. What the hell have I become?
Is there some sort of gay subtext there?
You know, I think it's interesting because he's not a specifically gay kid. I think he's really polysexual. He doesn't really know what he is yet. He's 14 or 15 in this story. But because he's like this force of nature, he's sort of everything. He doesn't need to be gay or straight or anything. And I wanted to write a story where the queerness was more like, well, you know, what happens when you suddenly feel like a monster? You don't fit in. Your effect on people is unpredictable or they don't like it. You're a monster, basically. And so it's like being a queer. And I kind of like the idea of doing this in a more sort of meta way where it's not specifically a gay kid. This is just a kid, right? And he's going through this crazy awakening and he has to deal with it somehow.
Well, and also, Trevor, you must face sort of, I'm a gay writer just for the gay audience.
Yeah.
It's like you want to branch out and write books that everybody wants to read.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote something a few years ago when we first had you on the show about Catholicism.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit and how that's being used as a textbook.
Yeah, and that's queer and Catholic. And, you know, the reason I called it queer and Catholic and not gay and lesbian or Catholic or GLBT and Catholic is because the queer thing is of interest to me, because that isn't just gay or lesbian. Right? Queer is really a very inclusive word. It includes trans and all sorts of things. And you can even be a straight queer. And I've always liked that idea.
I have some straight queer friends.
Yeah, we need to queerify. The whole world is queer. It just doesn't know it, right? So
uh-oh.
We can sort of...
It's the queer agenda.
But I'm sorry, you had asked...
Well, you had done the book about...
The book. So it was basically a collection of people's stories growing up queer and Catholic. And it ended up getting this... While it was being published, the publisher sold it to an academic press. So it ended up like this textbook. So it's like this hardback for $40. You know, you buy it when you're at some university. So nobody buys it in, like... the store. So it's weird. It's being taught in classes in, I don't know, Western Montana State. Every once in a while I get an email.
What classes is that being taught in? Gay studies? Or
well, I was
Catholic
at a divinity
studies?
School, Pacific School of Theology, and people are reading it there. So it would be a way to... There are a lot more churches actually interested, especially the more liberal churches, in how do gay and lesbian kids deal with being Christian and what are the challenges? So,
well, and we're having this huge movement about bullying right now. That's finally become a little bit more at a tipping point for consciousness to understand the dangers of this bullying thing.
Right.
Starting with many people who've laid the groundwork for that, including Deborah Chasnoff and Dan Savage and these various people who have paved the way.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems to be a mainstream sort of subject that people are willing to talk about.
Yeah.
And because that a lot of people who are bullied are gay, are queer.
Exactly. And seeing that this is something that these kids go through, and we want to know their stories, you know? We want to understand what's actually happening for a change instead of like, oh, you just get through that, and, you know, which is how we kind of learned to, no one talked about it.
Or we committed suicide.
Yeah, yeah.
Or got into
through
drugs
it, or
and
we
alcohol,
didn't get through it. Right.
Or had promiscuous sex and died of AIDS, or...
Mm-hmm.
Any number of ways that gay people have medicated
also,
themselves for all these years.
Yeah, which is also kind of what Fawn's about. Here's a kid who's really in danger of being one of these kids because he can't figure out any way to fit in. What's going to happen? What's he going to do?
You want to read another little piece from Fawn? I would love that.
So bringing up that
You're listening
challenge.
To Out in the Bay. I'm interviewing and talking with Trevor Healy. You can find him at Trevor with a B, TrevorHealy.com. He's the author of many books, a poet and essayist. Check him out, Trevor Healy.com. Here on Out in the Bay, I'm Marilyn Pittman. Got something?
Let me see. Something a little different.
Just don't have the seven words in it. Just not the Carlin words.
When he runs away, Gil had no idea where to go, just away from people. Not easy in an enormous metropolis like Los Angeles. He'd actually never left the city. He'd only been to Magic Mountain. But then he recalled from his previous trips there the big sloping empty grass hills of Valencia, and didn't the city sort of begin to dwindle out when you got up that way? He ran to the on-ramp onto the 5 and began hitchhiking. 10 minutes went by before he began to think about how he might appear to the endless parade of commuters. Who's going to pick up a punk goth Mexican teenager? He ran into a 99-cent store where he asked for a box and to borrow a Sharpie pen. He was back outside and onto the on-ramp in a flash, holding up his sign. And though it took him a good hour, he got a ride finally, and as he hopped into the big tractor trailer with his book bag and clarinet, he tossed his little "Not a Gangster" sign into the bushes and bid Los Angeles farewell.
You've been in Los Angeles for how long now?
I've been in Los Angeles for about 10 years.
And how has that affected you and your writing? Because this book is very much about...
Yeah, it's very much about that, and it's very much about the Mexican-American community, because I work for a nonprofit there, and we work with immigrants and the working poor, basically. So most of my time in Los Angeles has been spent more in the Latino community,
what
which has been very interesting.
What kind of work is that?
Well, we have campaigns around the city, so... We have a campaign at the port, so we have an environmental side, which we try to clean up a neighborhood. Like, all the kids have asthma around the port because the pollution's so bad. And then because trucking was deregulated, the trucks, they pollute because the drivers don't get paid anything. They're contractors, so they don't fix the trucks, so the trucks pollute. So we're trying to get the workers unionized, and of course the trucking companies fight that. So there's always several pieces. It's like, clean up the environment, get the workers a better job, which will help the families who live there and improve the city in general, bring more money into the community, which will help the community. So it's sort of it's a progressive agenda, and it has all these, we usually form a coalition of a whole bunch of different groups. There's usually clergy involved, anything we can get going. So there's a hotel campaign, which his mother's a hotel worker, Gilberto's mother in the story, mm-hmm. because right. I've worked with a lot of hotel workers, and these are low-wage, mostly women workers who have really demanding physical jobs, a lot of health problems because of it, and no health insurance. So there's these kinds of, the typical things you hear about in the neoliberal sort of world we're living in now. And that's been very interesting. But to get to know these people also and then be able to write about them has been really wonderful, because it's kind of a new world that I didn't experience in Northern California as much. I didn't know as many people like this. So L.A. is exciting that way. I feel like there's a lot of good things actually happening in L.A. I kind of got there at a good time. The whole city council sort of turned union left and Latino. And before that, it had been very conservative, mostly white guys, So I've been here at a time.
When you have
Villarosa
as the mayor.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole council is it helps us in our work because they generally support us. You still have to fight, business and other powerful players in the economy, but it's an interesting time to be in L.A.
And it's rewarding work. I mean, what got you, what is it that has motivated you to spend your life doing that, besides being a writer?
Well, I think, writing is one thing, but I've always felt it always feels like it's too much just me, myself, doing my own thing, and I've always wanted to be connected to the community somehow and be of some kind of service. So I think in a lot of ways I learned that, I had a brother who was sick when I was a kid, and then when the AIDS crisis, hit, it was like, okay, well, there's ACT UP and there's Queer Nation, and there were hospices. I worked at hospices as a volunteer, and I've always felt like I tutor kids now in reading. I just sort of think like that makes sense to like,
is that the good Catholic part of you?
That's, yeah.
The
I think
service,
that's the positive stuff I
to
kept.
Others.
Right. I mean, the world's screwed up, and there's a lot of work to be done, and I'm a single person without, kids or anything, so I can take all these jobs that don't pay well because, let's face it, a lot of people feel they can't do a lot of the service they want because they can't afford to do it. That's kind of weird in itself. Why don't we just pay, the people who do service work, billions of dollars, to motivate people and also to reward people for doing stuff like
and
that.
And bring up the middle class.
Yeah.
And keep the middle class alive.
So, it's rewarding. And then having been in San Francisco and going to L.A., it's really cool to feel like you can be part of making L.A. more like San Francisco, because San Francisco is a model of, recycling, the fact that they pay for the bags now. San Francisco does a lot of good stuff that other cities
follow. Well, they can't
seem
to fix the homeless, but other
well,
than
that's,
that.
And that's hard, because if San Francisco can't do it, you realize, wow, this is a real, that means it's a really big challenge.
It's an epidemic.
San Francisco's pretty good at, yeah.
We care about our environment.
We've got to find that.
Which is, the paper bags and the
right.
plastic bags, but the environment also includes the homeless.
Right.
And so that's also an environmental issue,
yeah.
I suppose.
And again, it's the economy. How do you create an economy that actually can work for those people? Because as the economy is complicated enough where people fall out of it and then there's nowhere to go. And we need a different system than that.
So what is it in your writing over the last 20 or so years? You've been writing for a long time. How do you see your writing having changed over this time, if at all? deepening or getting better? Is it easier? All those kinds of things that come
up. Yeah, I think it's easier. I think it's better. And I think that I've been able to get it away from myself so much. In other words, my first novel was kind of closer to my own story. And I think the more you write, the more you're able to write characters that don't have anything to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can really create
these people.
You're done
sort of fleshing out your own.
Yeah, and then suddenly the world is richer because you have a million people who can have a perspective instead of like, well, stuff is kind of from my perspective and I can create people who kind of are like that. And now it's like, well, there's a whole more variety. So I feel like it's a richer experience. It's more fun as well. But, you know, it remains challenging because you got to sit down and do it.
And are you still single just out of choice?
Well, I have a boyfriend in Argentina now from the trip, but he's far away, so I'm not sure what to call myself.
You call yourself a single guy with a boyfriend in Argentina.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's so gay male of you.
I guess, yeah.
That's fun. Well, it's great to see you again and great to talk to you. Is there anything else you'd like to read from us from Fawn or from A Horse Named Sorrow? I love your writing.
I'll read a little tiny bit from the beginning of A Horse Named Sorrow just to give you a little feel for... what happens to Seamus? Because he goes through this whole thing. He goes on this road trip after Jimmy passes away, and Jimmy asks him to take him back the way he came, and he came on a bicycle from Buffalo. So he gets on a bike and takes it literally, and he sort of gets lost out there, but it's also the way he finds himself home, or finds his way home. And in the end...
And in peril, to some extent. He has some dangers.
And in the prologue, we get a hint of maybe where he ends up. I'm going to read a little bit of that. I'm a clown. And I don't mean that in the sense of being a fool either, although I've been that too. I mean I'm an actual clown, as in I wear face paint, a big red nose, balloon pants, and giant orange shoes. I juggle, I fall, I'm a fool for hire now instead of just doing it pro bono. They call me Rusty, and I don't speak ever. So I guess you could say I'm a mime too. That's on account of Jimmy, who always told me I talk too much, and Eugene, who showed me how not to. The hardest part is not singing, of course, but I do hum and laugh and groan and make all the animal noises. I became a clown for the usual reasons, because things didn't work out on a grand scale. That's the cliché of clown stories, I know. Yet I didn't go bankrupt or lose my family in a tornado or anything like that. I just lost Jimmy, which amounted to the same thing, and then some.
It's really touching, the relationship between the two of them, because the thing that I love is when he, in that first scene, when he bathes, he decides he wants to bathe Jimmy. And it's such a tender, sensual, without being sexual necessarily, but it's sexual, but it's just tender and it's love. You know, it just feels like love that you're writing about. It's beautiful.
Thank you. I think some of that comes out of the preciousness when you loved people who were ill with AIDS, and people would hand massages, washing people's feet, that tenderness of love that so often people get too busy to be aware of, and you can have that now.
And brought the community together. It broke all our hearts open, as I recall.
Yes,
it's great to see you. It's great to have you on the radio show again. Trevor Healy is who I've been talking to here for this Out in the Bay show that you've been listening to. Trevor with a B, trevorhealy.com. Please look him up, buy his books, and support his work. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. Yeah, it's a weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. Our show streams and is on the air every Thursday at 7 p.m. And we archive it for podcasting and on demand at outinthebay.com. And we're on your phone. Just go to outinthebay.com and download the Stitcher app. We've been on the air for 8 years now. We need your support. Go to outinthebay.com. Hit that Donate Now button. Come on. Keep us on the air. Thanks to WY Enterprises for our website. They help you manage your life and your office. WYEnterprises.com. Hey, write us. Marilyn at outinthebay.com or Eric at outinthebay.com. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW, Joanne Marr is our engineer. Hey, Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me, and we just won. We're the recipients of the 2012 National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Excellence in Journalism Award. Yes, long awaited, and here it is. So we're enjoying that. We hope you tune in. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me. Thank you.